Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
I honestly cannot remember the last time I read a book that got me thinking so deeply. And one of the things about this book we're going to be talking about today is that it got me thinking about, among other things, thinking about what it means to be a thoughtful human being in the sense of thinking deeply and with purpose, and particularly the importance of living thoughtfully, within the context of what we sometimes refer to as good and evil. And what is it that allows certain people to actually fall into patterns of what at least most people would regard as utterly terrible behavior? Or if one wants to assign the term evil, how is it that people can sometimes find themselves acting in ways that that could be by some called evil, certainly doing terrible, terrible harm to their fellow human beings and seeming without being troubled by it. And the history of the world is littered with examples of this very, very troubling sort of behavior, behavior which can often spring out of sort of the ordinary stuff of life and in our day-to-day lives. That is explored in this fascinating new book, which is called The Evil of Banality, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. Its author, Elizabeth Minnick, received her doctorate from the graduate faculty of the New School under the direction of Hannah Arendt. And we will be talking about that name very specifically because it was something quite provocative written by Hannah Arendt a number of years ago that helps serve as the context for this really important new book. Elizabeth Minnick served 25 years as professor at the Union Institute, then appointed Distinguished Fellow President's Office of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. She is the author of Transforming Knowledge and the co-author of The Fox in the Hen House, How Privatization Threatens Democracy. This truly important new book is published by Roman and Littlefield. It is titled, once again, The Evil of Banality, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. Elizabeth Minnick, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. It's quite extraordinary to be here, and that was a wonderful introduction to the book. Thank you.
Well,
I feel like maybe we co-wrote this.
Hardly.
I
have to say my feeling was exactly the opposite in a sense. I mean, the book resonated with me, but I just thought, my word, somebody of tremendous intelligence and sensitivity has written this, and I felt like in a thousand years I could never have written something so important nor profound. I want to make sure we go no further without explaining the important work of someone who was a mentor and colleague of yours, Hannah Arendt, and what she wrote in the early 1960s during what you call stormy, fascinating, irregular times. Tell our listeners about what Hannah Arendt wrote and the firestorm of controversy that it set in motion.
Yes, and let me say up front that part of the fascination now, we can interweave this as we go, is that the phrase that I'm about to talk about that you have introduced here is the banality of evil, which that phrase right there itself is almost a banality these days, which is another one of the reasons I wrote this book, because we have yet to deal fully with the conjunction of banality, cliché, convention, mindless meanings that we pass back and forth like worn coins. So we don't have to think, we just get into them. What could that possibly have to do with evil, the doing of horrendous harms? So her challenge was to not just juxtapose, but relate these two apparently absolutely opposite meanings that we have. And it really is such an irony that the phrase itself can be reduced to a banality. We can do that to anything.
Very true.
Have to watch ourselves. Yeah, the history is that she, as someone who fled the Nazis, showing extraordinary political judgment, she knew when to get out, and she did, and many striking difficulties and so forth en route to this country. When Adolf Eichmann, one of the, not top, but in the concentric circles of the top Nazis, he's been called the engineer of the final solution of the genocide. Eichmann is the man who, obviously with other people, but he was in charge of making it possible to commit genocide. One of the things that we tend to forget, because if we think of evil as this monstrous act by sort of one or two monstrous people, we forget how much work, time, planning it takes to actually do that level of horrific harm. And Eichmann engineered it, as we say, the trains going to the killing camps ran on time. He was arrested. He was found where he had fled and brought to trial in Jerusalem. And Hannah Arendt convinced Mr. Sean of the New Yorker, I don't think he resisted, but in this case, she convinced him to send her to cover the trial. And she sat in the courtroom and she read the transcripts and she thought a great deal. She watched this man. And it struck her, she used to say she found herself with a concept, it's like it came to mind, that what she was seeing was the banality of evil, that this was not a monster. This was a cliched man, anxious, tense, hardly threatening then, of course. It wasn't he who did the murders, the vast numbers of murders. He worked at his desk. He made things work. And the conjunction of the genocide, which breaks our categories and was then even more so conceptually, sort of, what? You could try and remove the whole group of people, never to breed again, not just kill them all. Get everyone so that there will never be any more. That's an astounding thing. And to try and do it administratively. She used to talk about administrative murder, to do it efficiently and effectively. So here is this man who does things efficiently and effectively. He himself, I have heard, threw up and was very upset the one time he had even a glimpse of what it is that he was making possible. And as Arendt pointed out, he never did anything violent against anybody. So here's this man who is responsible with many, many other people, but in a very key way, and look at who he is. So she wrote about the trial. She wrote about him. She wrote about Nazism, mostly focusing on the trial, but she brought in the history and so forth. And she wrote, Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil. And when it came out in serial form in the New Yorker originally, then in a book, it proved enormously controversial. Fully understandably, we're not far from the Holocaust at that point and the World War and the terrible suffering and destruction, and she's talking about banality. And there were a couple of specific things in the book that she said that made people furious. In general, the framing of that reaction, which really was vitriolic and highly personalized, was this notion that she was trivializing, that she was saying that Eichmann, you know, was just trivial, which by extension meant that what he did was trivial. That's just unthinkable to people.
Of course. You write at one point, Arendt's thoughts about Eichmann, a significant perpetrator of the Holocaust, had taken her to conclusions for which many people evidently were not ready. And you say a little bit later in this very same introductory chapter, to think of evil as banal was then altogether too difficult. These were times in which unthinkable went with evil, with the Holocaust. Unthinkable, unspeakable, radical, evil, the very opposite of banal. And you go on to say, the evil of banality has haunted my thinking ever since it occurred to me. So in other words, these words that Hannah Arendt wrote have, in a sense, been a theme through much of what you have considered and written about and talked about and taught about over these subsequent years. I think that's what you're saying.
Indeed. She took me with her to some of these sessions when she was still trying to talk with people. I do want to say that I understand the outrage and the pain. We were close to horrific events. I don't write that off lightly. Of course, people were troubled by this. In that, thank you for reading that, Greg. That's right. People were not prepared. I don't wish to be saying really much about the people. This was terribly troubling and understandably. I'm sitting in the back. People are being that kind of angry. She's still trying to talk. And this phrase, the evil of banality, came to my mind. And I wondered if she had spoken of the evil of banality rather than the banality of evil, if that would have made it more possible for people to hear at least some of what she was saying. Behind that, immediately, and this is, you're absolutely right, haunted me. It's been an inquiry of decades. It's seemed to me one of the most important, maybe the most important moral political question I could possibly ask. I needed to try and understand this, which is, what is it about banalities, which I usually define as the ordinary with the life sucked out of it? The ordinary can be rich and full and wondrous. We know that. We can have rich, full lives, ordinary lives. That, however, can be reduced to what I was calling earlier, these coins, well-worn coins that we hand back and forth. You know, hello, how are you? I'm fine. How are the kids? That's fine. It gets us through our days. We have other things on our mind. But when that kind of thinking takes over too much of our mind, it's not thinking, that avoidance of thinking takes up too much of our minds, we start gliding over the surface of experience and relations with other people, not taking them in, not being attentive. You can't even get people say we fail in empathy. We're nowhere near it because we don't even really recognize that there's a claim on our attention out there.
Right. We see repeatedly in your book the term isolation. That there is an isolation in a state of isolation in many of our lives that once upon a time was perhaps not there. And that is part of what leads us to where we are. Let me reintroduce you. My guest on today's morning show, Elizabeth Minnick, has written a powerful, profound book titled The Evil of Banality, on the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And in this book, Elizabeth Minnick is exploring how it is that truly monstrous, monumental evil can emerge, in a sense, out of the lives of ordinary people who are in one way or another complicit. And of course, we can think, for instance, of the Holocaust, but there are many other examples through world history, including the shameful legacy of slavery within the United States. And there were all kinds of people complicit in that who did not seem to understand or grasp the part that they were playing in this harm to fellow human beings. And how is it that such a thing can occur? That is part of what is explored in this book. It might be helpful at this point in time to talk about a distinction that you mentioned early on and which you then examine in great detail later in the book, the difference between extensive and intensive evil. I wonder if you would explain what that distinction is and then also explain why that distinction matters, why it is important when we think about things like terrible things that human beings do to other human beings.
It's exactly the right question, Greg. Thank you. We need it at this point in our conversation. When I started trying to understand what banality might possibly have to do with evil, since they seemed so opposite, I started reading everything from history to trial transcripts to plays to novels, all efforts to see if I could glimpse minds at work trying to make sense of what evil is and how it is that we enable, don't stop, become complicit, become perpetrators. What are we thinking when we do these things? All of them, each of them, different in degree, but they can shade into each other too. As I was doing all of this, reading and listening and thinking about such a pressing issue to my mind and heart, it suddenly dawned on me, this too was like a concept that just sort of came to mind, that what I might be able to say, having taken in from all these people who undertook to understand the doing of great harm, what I might come to be able to say with their help and instruction about some kinds of harm, evil, wouldn't work at all with some others. That there were, in fact, two vast kinds. Nothing is absolute and neatly divided, of course, but this is conceptually, I think, useful. One is the intensive evil, which is what comes to mind immediately, where the doer and the deed are, I'm going to say, morally commensurate. That is to say, a horrific deed done by a horrific person or group, small group, a serial killer, a cult that dismembers animals and children and eats them. the things that make us say, oh, this is extraordinary. This is so shocking. This can't have happened here. Not ordinary, absolutely not ordinary. That is the opposite of banal. Hellfire has burst through the crust, and these things tend to involve, they tend to, almost always, one person, a small group of people, and they don't last. Ordinary life continues around it. These are literally extraordinary. They are not normalized. People don't slide inadvertently into doing them. We might have enabled them in some profoundly, socioeconomic sense, but each of us did not enable it. This is entirely different, to go back to the distinction we were making earlier on, with the extensive evils, certainly the Holocaust, Rwanda, the genocide, enslavement, quite right, I talk about that too, and the sexual use and abuse and violation of the vulnerable, exploitation of labor unto death in some cases, etc. They take time, they take many, many, many people to do, which means, basically, that they have to be normalized. They're not extraordinary. They have to be made ordinary in a way that twists what this the rich loam of ordinary good lives, when we're fortunate enough to have such lives, ordinary good lives, twists them into normalized participation. Whether we're doing something or not, we are part, specifically, that is, if we're being a perpetrator or not, we are part then of a meaning system which is expressed. Usually the science reflects it. If you look into the science of these times, racism, racist science that supported it, religions supported enslavement, and the kind of treatment of the vulnerable sexually for a long time. Religions have their role in that. Whole systems of knowledge have their role in that. Economic systems prop it up. This is across many dimensions of meaning systems, other sorts of systems by which we live more or less consistently, as I said, over time for many, many people. And the doers are, for the most part, massively for the most part, not apparently commensurately evil of the evil with the evil of which we are part.
Mm. I really appreciate how you take the time in the book to, for instance, explain how slavery in our country was an example of this kind of extensive evil. And I honestly have to say, I'd never really stopped to think about all of the participants in the practice of slavery. And you outline them, you all but list them in your book. I mean, from the people who built the boats to the people who took those boats across the sea, to those who gathered the people who would become slaves, to those who guarded them, to those who helped them disembark off the boats, who guarded them during those infamous auctions, to those who transported them, to say nothing of those who purchased slaves and did the, you know, the sort of the direct enslavement, but then neighbors who accepted that fully and so on. I mean, the participants, whether active or passive, I mean, it was this enormous swath of the population. And as you say, people who in that moment, at least by and large, did not seem to fully grasp just what they were doing or the way in which their compliant acceptance of this made them participants in a way that now we look back on with profound shock.
It reminds us, when we start looking at these, I'll say concentric circles again, of participation when something has been normalized. It does remind us of the extraordinary interweaving of our activities as we go about our lives. And then we have to come back to, once we've sort of been through these lists, we have to come back to, okay, the question I posed at the beginning and that runs through the book, which is, what were they thinking? What am I thinking? What would I have been thinking? What's going on in your mind when you're seeing these things with your own eyes? In many cases, you know that's going on, even if it's normalized, even if it's supported by the authorities of the time, which the extensive evils need to have been, or they would have been stopped. They have spread and gone into every niche and corner of the society and the economy. How do we become immured to experience that is right there before our eyes? One response to that, that I think is obviously, I think it's crucial. I can say more about other things that are related, but certainly, insofar as we move into not thinking about what we're experiencing, when we pull out the phrases we already have. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the lasting problems of racist speech and sexist speech, these otherwise kind of habitually culture-wide demeaning lessenings of individuals and of groups and of histories and so forth, where those become the worn coins, the prejudices, prejudicial, where we already know who, what somebody is before we have experience. So we don't have that experience because we already know who this is. We already know that this person is maybe nice, but, you know, inferior, not able to do certain things. So it's okay that we keep them, maybe us, in that kind of role. And people internalize it, even those who are suffering it in many ways, when it's been normalized to that extent. I wouldn't overdo that, because we are thinking creatures and minds will kick in. But if it, you know, when something is entirely in the culture, it's going to have widespread effects, difficult to cast off. So if we're not thinking, by which I mean being aware, as they say, not just awake, but aware, that we can be startled back into thinking. We're going on about our daily life. We're surrounded by others who basically think similarly about these issues. We have little phrases that come out of our mouths we don't even notice. Greg, you know, when I was growing up, I'm a fairly senior person at this point, people, white people, actually used to say, hey, I can do, kids used to say this, I can do whatever I want. I'm free, white, and 21.
Interesting.
Isn't that something?
Wow.
And we still say, somebody said just the other day to me, you know, if I do this, I'm going to get sold down south. Which I've heard off and on for years.
Wow.
And it, that's what I mean by these things getting into the, into our minds, and they stop them.
Right.
They stop our minds. And I want to do a quick parallel, and then I'll stop this here. One of the things that, about banality and evil, the doing of horrific harm, that is so far more than bad that we have to leave it that those categories. We're without categories, as you said at the beginning, Greg. We go to the, you know, to the unspeakable, unthinkable. You can't just say the Rwandan effort at genocide was a bad thing. It was bad of you to do that. We need other categories. The category of evil we use, I'm not doing even anything theological at all here. I'm just saying this is the meaning we have because our minds can't use our regular categories there. This phenomenon breaks our regular categories, which makes us kind of helpless. Okay, so we're not thinking when we're confronted with evil.
Right, when we because we use the term unthinkable. And you go on to say also that most of us typically don't like to think about evil, except maybe when we're, you know, watching a film or reading a thriller or something. And of course, that is the phenomenon, I think, or an example of the romanticizing of evil. But when it comes to out-and-out evil, the most staggering kind of evil that is experienced in the world, most of us shy away and call it unthinkable, in part so we don't have to think about it.
And we would use the wrong categories. We say Hitler did it. Hitler could no more have done what was done. It's impossible. He couldn't have. A small group of people couldn't have. Extensive evils cannot be done by only a few. But we persist. They can't. I think about the kind of work as you were doing with the enslavement, too. It depends on everybody, virtually everybody. There are always exceptions, wonderfully enough. But virtually, there's intensive good, too. so there are always some. But you cannot do these enormous harms unless you have many more. But we use our categories. We say, that person is doing it. And we use that name. And we get furious at that person. That person, all by him, her, there, itself, cannot do it.
You write it.
Can just the inner circle.
Absolutely. You write at one point, and this is in that portion of the book when you are talking about all who participated in one way or another in the practice of slavery. It is not ever just the visible, the them, the singular agents who do extensive evils. Not possible. Not at all. In other words, it would be impossible to accomplish extensive evil on that extensive scale were there not all kinds of people participating in one way or another. And at some point in the book, you talk about how this is especially possible when those who are perhaps in authority or in a position to do so, in a sense, co-opt words like ordinary and everyday and normal and decide for the rest of us what is ordinary, what is normal, what is regular, and then act upon our deepest fears when the life of ordinary Americans, for instance, is threatened by something or someone. That's part of the heart of what you're talking about.
It is indeed, and it's why in this expanded edition of the book, we decided to put in this piece that I called Why Not Lie, along with a piece on teaching thinking, since that seemed necessary given what I was talking about. The Why Not Lie is essential. The question, why not lie, is essential to this discussion, because lying, like the violence that we see in with extensive evils, is a way of stealing reality from us. And one of the lines in Why Not Lie that stays with me, I wrote it, it stays with me, is reality is not of our making, but it is in our keeping. We can shut our minds off. We can be lied to. We can lie to ourselves, fascinatingly enough, same phenomenon that allows us to think about our own thinking and to have a conscience to think about what we do. We have that doubleness within ourselves that allows us to be aware. Sometimes we dumb it down, numb it out, can't do that every moment, but it's there. And what lying does is it steals something of reality from the people to whom I lie. It's an effort to change reality according to my will. I didn't do that. That didn't happen. Yes, it did. No, it didn't. If you contradict yourself and keep this up, the possibility of anybody who is listening to you and taking you seriously, or even simply trying to keep their feet on the ground in relation, the ground is being shaken so that the people around the lying end up having to watch only those who are lying to find out what's supposed to be real. Our own experience is being taken from us. Let me give you an example of how that relates to violence and the extensive evil. If you have a lie, I'm going to call this is one of the, I call it the social and political lies, as well as the personal, as I said, if you have a lie that this whole group of people is fundamentally inferior across all measures, or anyhow, any measures that you consider important to the definition of a proper human being, that's a lie. It's contradicted by reality all the time. If you're going to sustain that lie, one of the things you can do, if you have power, can get power one way or another, is force reality to conform to it. So the next thing you know, what you've got is, for example, with enslavement, it was a capital crime for somebody who was enslaved to learn to read. And if you saw 12 years a slave, that he had to hide that he could read and write. And when they found out, they came close to killing him. What you're doing with that is trying to remake reality. If he were incapable of these, quote, higher order abilities, you wouldn't have to do that. What's being admitted with this, keeping all females out of education, out of higher education, out of some fields, some of the supposedly brainiest fields for a very long time, and professions, if you do that, don't give people a chance to disprove, because you know they can. You actually do know that because you do have experience all the time. You have to make yourself into a superior person, which is a lot of work and makes you a bit touchy when somebody challenges it. If you have to change reality, you have to make it correspond. See, those women are just sort of silly. They can't reason.
It's a case of, in a sense, stacking the deck, or maybe another way to think about it is creating a system, creating an order in which, in a sense, what you want to be true or wish to be true or your gut tells you is true, to, in a sense, make it feel even more true. I mean, to reinforce those kind of inclinations that one might have about who we are and how the world is put together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when it becomes extensive and normalized en route to extensive, perhaps, then you have to go past that well-described phenomenon that I'm sure we have all done. The temptation of lying is huge, actually. One of the things that I found as I was thinking about it, it's kind of like a magic power. Hey, I didn't do that. Okay, I can walk away. That's magic. I wave a wand and say something and it's done. So we do that. It has consequences, is the problem. And when you get to, I become less my own friend, so I don't think as well if I've lied to myself. There are things I don't think about. So my mind is going to be hampered, and my relations with other people and so forth, my experience of the world. If you move that to the scale, as I was saying, and as you have fully gotten, helped us see, when you get to the level of the massive harm doing over time, then you've got lying becomes, I don't like analogous, it's a vehicle, a preparation for an enactment of the violence you were doing to make the world conform to it.
Hmm. It's one of the ways in which your book really so very well serves its subtitle, On the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. It gets us thinking about thinking and the importance of thinking and the way in which sometimes we think in ways that aren't really thinking at all, aren't really truly, mm-hmm. truly thoughtful. At one interesting point in the chapter, which is called Escaping Explanations and Excuses, which I want to talk about briefly, where you kind of outline a few of the catch-all phrases that are maybe kind of convenient shortcuts to maybe trying to understand all of this. Ahead of that, you say, when we are actually thinking, we will not fall back into concepts that can block us from apprehending reality, from being open to experiences, because thinking, as Hannah Arendt puts it, unfreezes concepts, even those we have discovered or created ourselves. And that's so interesting to think about, that's one of the best things about thinking, is that it unfreezes a concept. It makes it malleable and pliable, and we can see it in different ways. We can even discard it in favor of something that makes more sense. But there we see how some people are probably frightened by the notion of that kind of thinking, because they want to live in a world of clarity, of blacks and whites and rules and expectations and so on. They do not want to live a life in which there is this, let's call it, sort of uncertainty, unfrozen state of what we would like to assume is just immovable and always true.
Yes. One of the other things that Hannah used to say is that there are no dangerous thoughts. Thinking is dangerous. Precisely because you're thinking when you have, like when I said something about hearing somebody I got told down south for doing that. And we both looked at each other and went, how did that get in? You know, how is that? And you become aware of it. I always think of it as kind of, you were on a train and you were going somewhere, you knew where you were going, and then there's a possibility of getting off the train and wandering around and looking at where the train is going and the territory. The richness of experience is open, more or less, sometimes magnificently, sometimes just a little bit, when something that we were just using conceptually, the popular phrase for this is, you know, we were seeing through lenses. It comes from philosopher Kant, actually. People use it for his work all the time, but it's become widespread now. You say, you know, if you have blue glasses on, you've always had blue tinted glasses on, and one day you get a glimpse of around the edges of your glasses, and you realize it's the glasses that are blue, not the world. That's a really significant change. And we have picked this up. People will say, well, you know, through those lenses, you know, they're seeing through this lens, and you can change this lens. We are aware of these things. And what I really wanted to say with this, too, and in our present situation and in the world as we go through it, also historically, to be open to experience, not just to suffer from it, not just to try and pre-shape it, to be in relation to experience of realities and all their complexity, and they change, realities do, to have some chance of comprehending realities. That's such an extraordinarily rich gift. You put it beautifully, Greg. If we stay within our categories, if we keep those glasses on, even though we've had a glimpse, because we want to go on seeing the blue because we love it, on one hand, that's fine. Of course, we need order, and we need to be able to put our feet on the ground, and we need to be able to speak what I tend to think of now as sort of tending the commons of the mind. We need to have the commons of the mind in which we can communicate with each other. We have to sustain these things, but we also need to turn the soil and let new growth come up. Otherwise, those old roots from the past extensive evils, they're still sending up sprouts. We have to keep an eye out for them.
For sure. And I appreciate the fact that your book includes, in a sense, a rejection. Maybe that's a little too harsh a way to put it, but you call into question some of the ways in which we tend to frame this, to frame the unthinkable. When we you know, if we pose the question, how could they do that? How could anybody do this terrible thing? And then you go through a long list of such catch-all phrases like, well, we have this way of compartmentalizing, or it has something to do with original sin, or everybody was doing and just going along with the crowd, or it was self-defensiveness, or so on. And there's quite a number of them, and we read them one after another, and yep, these are all sort of shortcuts to try to understand this. One of the most telling is the last of this list, fear of the other. You write, this is the explanation I've heard most often in recent years. I cannot credit it. It avoids too many questions. You go on to say, if that were true, that we were wired to fear someone who is other, different than us, then how do you explain all of the instances in the human experience in which we experience just the opposite, where we relish the opportunity to meet somebody that comes from another place and cooks another kind of food and sings a different kind of music and so on. It's very, very clear that we don't all have this wiring where we only want to be with people who are exactly like ourselves, but somehow that becomes ingrained. Somehow we are taught, some of us, unfortunately, are in a sense taught to see ourselves and the world that way.
Yes, and the prevalence of fear of the other now has been around for some time, and you can find it in multiple traditions, of course, but it comes up so quickly. Let me just say this, Greg. One of the things I learned to watch for in myself and others is I'm on this quest to say, what happens to our minds that we do this, that we don't see what we're doing? This notion of other, I'm going to say it, it is precisely, it's a banality. We go right smack there and we're done. yes. And then we try and explain it again, as you were saying earlier, that because it, now we don't have to think about it. It's stopped. We feel safer. And people will then take it to this level of science. They'll put it in our wiring one way or another. Sin, science, whatever, that it's just there. It's in the lizard brain, another phrase I hear a lot of. we use a lot of pseudoscience as a way of, I don't mean there isn't some meaning in science to that, but it becomes popularized and becomes a banality. And it just says, oh, there it is again. This is the equivalent of boys will be boys. They just like that. Well, that leaps right over the question of how can they do it? How does it get licensed such that we just go over that? How did these categories of kinds of people get set up? Not every culture, not every history, not every person actually experiences these that humans come in kinds like that. We don't actually come in kinds. Another one of Hannah's wonderful lines that is what humans have the paradox. This is my paraphrase, Bruce, I think. Humans have the paradoxical commonality of being each and every one unique.
That is something we share in common, that we are each unique.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. These experiences of differences all the way to capital O, other, are to be thought about. It's not the given. And if we don't stop and think about them, where did that one come from? What work is it doing and for whom? Whom is it harming? What am I missing in life if I just let that sit there as a category? I would like to live more fully than that. It's not only about not hurting other people, it's not hurting ourselves. How do we stay awake and aware in this world? Those categories are not necessary.
Hmm.
We can think about them.
Absolutely.
And when we do that, they tend to loosen up.
Absolutely. And of course, the whole second half of your book, which sadly we don't have really time to explore today, is about the matter of good and of how good emerges sometimes very directly in the face of extensive evil, and that is also something worth pondering and understanding better. I want to read one of my favorite paragraphs because I think it gives a really nice sense of the tenor of this book. You write at one point, "Please excuse me," talking to the reader. "Please excuse me if I seem to repeat myself. I am not assuming you did not understand the first time. I am turning concepts this way and that, revisiting them, unfreezing them, so as to keep thinking with, about, through them. In quest of and to keep practicing fresh thinking, I am trying to avoid just adding another couple of conceptual pens to our mental holding areas." It is such a beautiful turn of phrase and speaks to the importance of thoughtful living. And another quote from the book, which I love from the introduction, "People who are not thinking are capable of anything, including really terrible things." And I think your book gives us so much to think about in the best sense of the word. The book, again, is The Evil of Banality, on the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. The book is published by Roman and Littlefield, the author, Elizabeth Minnick. Elizabeth Minnick, I cannot think of the last time I read a book that touched me so deeply and provoked me to thinking about basic matters of life in such profound ways. I thank you for creating such an important book, and I thank you for the privilege of speaking with you about it on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Greg. We need thinking friends in order to go on thinking, and it's a great pleasure to find one.
Mm.
And all the people who listen to you, thank you for doing this work.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, the 30th of April, we will commemorate National Autism Awareness Month with two interviews out of the Morning Show archives. The first with best-selling author Cy Montgomery, talking about her fascinating biography of Temple Grandin. And then to fill out the hour, a portion of the interview that I was privileged to record with Temple Grandin herself, one of the most famous Americans to live with autism. And she, of course, has written very persuasively about the ways in which her autism actually enables her to do the work that she does with animals even better than she otherwise could. Her famous book is called Animals in Translation. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our weather forecast calls for partly cloudy skies today, windy conditions and a high of 73 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight, but quite cool Tonight's low will be 38 degrees, partly sunny and much cooler than today, with tomorrow's high just 57 degrees. We'll have a high on Thursday of 63 with rainy conditions. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.